It's just past 18 hours, 30 minutes and 32 seconds East African time. Time for John Sibi Okumu on Wednesday. This being Wednesday, the 28th of June, 2023. Hamjambo na karibuni, hello and welcome. And happy Eid al-Adha to our Muslim listeners. Good people, you must have got used to the gambit of having you and our mystery guest listen to random answers to a sample question from random people as a lead-in to our conversation. Well, there's a bit of a change for this edition. This time, you are the target of my questioning. On Sunday, the 18th of June this year, I was at a concert in Nairobi which had the poster heading Kenya at 60, celebrating Kenya's 60 years of independence. You see how influential we are? Be that as it may, we are going to play you some music. And the question is, can you identify, as I am more than certain that our very knowledgeable guest can, what you are about to hear by artist and title? A bit like, for example, The Beatles, Twist and Shout. You can tell how old I am, can't you? Anyway, here goes. So, you've worked out that our focus is not on popular or pop music, but on what is called classical music. So, Gwiji Wetu, what was that?
That was Beethoven's Ninth Symphony in D minor, first movement.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you're a better man than I am. I knew it was Beethoven. I would have said that, but I wouldn't have gone much further. So is it too much of a silly question to ask, is there a definition of classical music? Or just the minute you hear violins and trumpets and flutes, it must be classical music?
Very good question. There is several definitions of classical music. They are all dependent on so many different factors. The most accepted, the most widely known definition is, yes, when you put a lot of those instruments together, people would call that classical music. But actually, in essence, classical music refers to a period in time and a culture where music was composed specifically for that medium to be performed in the concert hall, because that was the dominant sort of musical output of Western Europe for about 400 years, starting around 1550, 1560. And that became what's called the classical music, music that was written specifically to be performed in that setting with those instruments or voices.
Gwiji, I hear you, but I'd like to know, normally, as I say, we have vox pops, we walk around the streets of Nairobi or Kisumu or Eldoret or whatever, and get people to comment on some question. But we were a bit stuck this time round
because I ask you, how many Kenyans would have given the answer that you've just given me, who are exposed to this kind of music, like it, listen to it, attend concerts, etc.?
A very small number of Kenyans in general would probably define classical music using those terms. And maybe even a small number of those who actually play classical music might define it using those terms per se, because that is information that you have to look for, because it's not the music. The definitions are not what you listen to. You listen to the sounds, right?
Right.
And so the definitions, what it's called and some of that history, become something you have to have a particular interest to dig and acquire. So no, a very small number of Kenyans would actually define it or even need to.
So am I likely to receive hate mail for having dedicated an edition to discussing classical music at Kenya 60 on this? Is it irrelevant?
Let's wait.
Is this an irrelevant conversation?
Let's wait and see. I think the it's a very interesting topic, generally speaking, and it always receives varied feedback unless you get it right. So what happens is, as a thing by itself, when people meet classical music for the first time, it's really not for you until it makes sense. So people who finally receive music and they go like, wow, that spoke to me, and then they start giving it a different kind of review. But otherwise, if you just present classical music and either you don't get it right or it doesn't, so to speak, hit home, in Nairobi, in Kenya, sometimes people will be like, "Yo, nini, yo, that's not for us. That's it sounds very foreign, very different."
Well, I'll tell you, I was alluding to my dinosaur years in the introduction, but I'll tell you, Guiji, how when I was at high school, I was in a boarding school. It was one of those boarding schools in the wake of independence, which was bringing together all the Kenyan races, but it was bringing together all the Kenyan races in a school that had hitherto been, so to speak, white. But then I think it was Gashadhi or some man said, you know, let's a report, we're independent, we've got to do our own thing. So there I was at this boarding school, and we had a music teacher. And I remember pretty much as you say, that we were obliged during the music lesson to sit down, and everybody, obedience was key, because the rod had not been spared, nor the child being beaten by the rod. And in absolute silence, the record player would be switched on, and we would be obliged to listen to, having been explained that there were four movements in the symphony, it began, and then you listen to movement number one. But then if it was the New World Symphony, you said, it wasn't, you weren't to say Dvorak, you were to say Dvorak, and the New World Symphony was all about going to discover America as a new institute. And then it became clear to you that indeed, if you listen carefully, it did tell a story through music over a period of time in a tender, attaching sort of way. And the four seasons did represent different times of the year, even if one hadn't experienced winter. So I can see that we're basically saying that classical music grows on one.
It does. It definitely grows on one. And you've hit the nail on the head by saying you had to sit in silence.
Yes.
Because classical music is a very interesting kind of offering. Classical music needs you to attempt to accept it. The idea of being still, sitting in silence. So it fits in the realm of experiences like looking at a sunset or something like this. You have to sit still. You have to actually make some effort to receive the offering. The offering doesn't grab you and say you're going to listen whether you like it or not. Mikono juu, clap. It actually is more, if you sit and give it the attention, then there's a chance it will speak to you. And I think it's partly for this reason that classical music has ended up in different corners of society where stillness is an option as a way of life.
Yes.
And where stillness is not an option as a way of life, where there's a little bit more hustle and bustle, classical music does not have the muscle to fight its way on the sonically, doesn't have the muscle to fight its way against all the other life sounds, life noises that we live with. So that's an interesting thing. I guess well done for going to a school that allowed you this opportunity.
Yes. Well, it was a great boon and a blessing when one was slightly older, in the sense that when you heard it again, it's the whole business of exposure. One knew what one was dealing with. But again, I'd ask you, if there was an interest to be displayed, if it was a pop, I was talking about the Beatles, you know, the Beatles versus the Rolling Stones in my teenagehood, would one have to go back, said, I like classical music, and I'm going to wade through each and every composer until I find, because everybody in the pop music world, you have the musician whom you like. You choose your musician. So we've got all these names. We've got Beethoven, we've got Chopin, we've got Liszt, we've got Handel, the Messiah. All these things are sort of buzzwords. How should one expose oneself in later age and sort of progress? Because by the time you've got to the Planets or something, that's pretty, Wagner is a bit difficult.
Holst, Gustav Holst. It's quite a journey into classical music. It moves in different dimensions. The first dimension is in complexity, because the art itself was a highly technical thing. And so at the beginning of classical music, the tools that were used by the artists, the sonic tools, the sound options that they had, and they got really good at them, and then they did more with them, and had and invested more in how to expand what they could. So it grew in complexity, and that makes it so less accessible. If you're starting into classical music, you happen to start with Gustav Holst for the first time,
yes,
you starting from a fairly complex piece might make it more difficult to access all the nuance that's in there. So, but there is a lot of classical music that is more accessible. The sequencing and the amount of information that's packed in there is not so much. And so that's a better place to start. That's the first dimension.
Is there such a thing as a simple composer? Like, go for him.
Well, is such a thing as a simple composer, technically speaking. And yes, simple composers, the way I see it, I'll speak for myself, I don't speak for the entire classical world. A simple composer, I think, is somebody who has less meaning in what they're trying to say.
Right.
But somebody could write only two notes, but depending on the meaning and the value that they put on those two notes, then they are actually a very complex composer, because they speak life, they speak culture, they speak history.
Oh dear. Wait a minute. There's the one that I've heard. The guy who goes, da 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 da.
Yes.
Da 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 da. Yeah, Ravel.
Yes.
Well, he's doing the same thing 1,000 times, but it's considered a classic, or classical music.
Exactly, it is. Now, that is a perfect example.
But it is simple.
It is simple in the sense of the number of notes he's using and the rhythms he's using and the amount of repetition. And he layers it so cleverly. But you have to be able, you have to expect that layer, and you have to accept the layer as it comes in. And then as the music builds up, what happens is it builds to a climax. It builds this energy to climax and then dies away. And so it is simple, exactly, in the sense that it's less of the tools available that he could have used and the instruments he could have used. He's used less of them, very minimal. But at the same time, it's not that simple, because the amount of meaning packed behind, that's what makes it a masterpiece, even though it's simple. And now we have the opposite. We have a lot of music that is a million notes on the page and actually no message, no depth. So the composer doesn't live anymore in, you know, through that music, or nothing lives out of that music. Let me not say nothing, but maybe less lives out of that music than Bolero.
Right. It's time for us to make our first stop. And again, to give you warning of the next bit of our conversation, is that being again a young person, we had something about the history, because I remember on the radio, there was a gentleman called Nat Kofsky, and he played all these things and was so knowledgeable and introduced them. And we've lost that. He is gone, and his education of us is gone. So history, but for now, a break. Capital FM. Guiji, history,
Again, when we talk about English, there's this sort of derogatory, dismissive saying, Kizungu ilikuja na meli, you know, came by boat, the strange alien language. There's antipathy. Does the history of classical music point to people sort of fobbing it off and saying enough of this, or has it been welcomed over the last 60 years? And I'm a bad interviewer. Tell us something about the history. Let's make it more broad-minded. You know more than I do.
You've put it in context very well by saying English Kizungu or English Kiingereza, because there is how classical music came to these shores in the first place. Now, the history, the bigger history, and I'm excited now, as I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking about the multidimensionality of classical music. Because, you see, England was never in itself a headquarters of classical music at any point. There's been great composers out of England and Britain, but actually classical music in its highest form was domiciled not in the UK or England. It was domiciled in maybe Germany or Italy, or, you know, via Austria. So it got to England, and as a result, I think, again, disclaimer, this is more my personal opinion, I think the English are the best academics of classical music. They didn't necessarily create it, but I think they have studied it. And so when English came to Kenya, with all the things that English came to Kenya with, classical music was one of them, approached from a very English perspective, which is different from what you'd see further west in Western Europe, Russia. It's very different how the English approach classical music. And how they approach classical music is how it was approached here. So we ended up with the cultural concert hall as much as it could fit. So starting from as early as, I think, 1927, there was attempts to play classical music in Kenya in different ways. There was a band in Dar es Salaam, even earlier than that, and right up till 1927, and they had, you know, African people of African descent learning to play instruments, and they had a marching band over there. A few of them were part of the very early starts of trying to perform as an orchestra in Nairobi, and they would be transported over and they would form an orchestra. But as a regular thing, it wasn't until about in the 1940s, after the Second World War, that actually classical music took off as a regular cultural offering in Nairobi. The interesting thing is that the Nairobi Orchestra, for example, as we know it, is one of the most enduring ensembles, one of the most enduring groups. And this was formed partly using Italian prisoners of war. The World War had ended, and there was all these prisoners held in different parts of the world by Britain, and they were released and, you know, given land or whatever. And some of them who are musicians in the military ended up playing music and forming part of the beginning of the Nairobi Orchestra. It's around 1947, and that went on to be quite a prolific, quite a well-known orchestra right up till independence. So there's one of the things that happened is at that time, Kenya was viewed as a prime destination for wealthy English people. And so Nairobi, stopping in Nairobi in any capacity, including as a musician. So people would stop in Nairobi and then go to Cape Town or somewhere. And then people were proud to say, I've played in Nairobi. And it also had the novelty of being this classical music being played far out in quotes at the equator. And you know, out in Africa. So the idea of a theater, but still there was a community of people that maintained it quite steadily right up till independence. The important part for us is after independence, as I guess around a time when you said you were in a school that was doing some integration of all the races in Kenya, and that started happening across the field. And so inevitably, as people got more access, classical music in itself started opening up even more to Kenyans of African descent. Although, because of this description that I gave earlier, that classical music needs you to be able to sit still enough to participate in it, it was always easier for an international population or an expatriate population or fairly wealthy population to sit and accept the classical music and learn how to do it. The other side of it is because of the instruments that are used to play classical music, it needed years, it still does, needs years of absolute focus and practice to learn how to play it. And so people fell along the way, and only very few people managed to get on to play the music that existed. And brings me to a very interesting point, because what did not take off, which I wish it had, was people using what they had learned so far to write music and play it. But the way classical music is set up, this body of music that came from Europe, that's 400 years old, it's a massive collection of pieces from so many composers, and accessing that music becomes a part of learning to play the instrument. And so people went so far, alafu kisha, if you don't get to the highest level for different reasons, because life doesn't allow you the access or the consistency, and then you fall by the wayside. And that meant it stayed very narrow until, you know, recently, all through independence. But I think the important thing, Mwalimu, is to note that Natkowski, who you've mentioned, and a few others, made great effort within their own capacity to try and expand this reach and sustain the music. And they and a few others have kept a string alive from independence to now that we've been able to pull on and try and build on and build something bigger and different.
Well, my area of expertise, I'd say, would be the theatre. And I don't know whether there are any parallels, because you're actually saying that classical music in itself was there. There was a great stash of gold, and you could go and take an ingot and sort of enjoy it and appreciate it. But in the theatre, I think there was a movement where people were saying, Il qua kitu ya koloni, they enslaved us, and now we're moving more and more towards doing our own thing. And therefore, there could be chapters in the history of Kenyan theatre where, you know, there were things to be destroyed. So if some wonderful English actor, Sir Ralph Richardson or somebody, had come and signed their name on the walls of the National Theatre, the first thing to do was to douse it with black paint and sort of destroy it. You know, this whole business of, you know, there's Rhodes statue in the middle of a university, we've got to destroy it because that reminds us of something that is unpalatable. Now, it was that. Would you say that in the last 60 years that the performance of classical music has changed in order to, yeah, sort of, you know, own it?
Yes.
Niyetu.
Yes.
Niyetu.
Yes. Niyetu. Yeah. It's a very interesting thing. Yes. Yeah. In classical music, it happened a lot later than in probably other artistic fields.
Mm.
So there would have been authentic and high quality Kenyan theatre, I'm guessing. I don't know. In the 60s and 70s, there should have been those Kenyans.
I would say there wasn't, but let's.
I don't know.
That's another conversation.
But definitely.
But the pushback,
yes,
the rejection factors,
definitely happened.
I'm
so
keen.
What happened is, I think classical music was safe because Kenyans did not really want to own it in the first place. It was this thing that was so far removed that they didn't. But until much later, so it was in the 2000s where there was a direct push to say, actually, we can do this. And there was a lot of Kenyans coming into the scene and trying, and wanachekelewa. It was actually funny because I was there. I experienced quite a lot of, you know, the sort of, what are you trying to do with that instrument?
Well, it's the same with lots of things. I think that, I mean, to have lived in various eras, decades, take for rugby, for example, the fact that, you know, if you sort of, like, you're a black person and you went and played for a white team, like nondescripts, you played for nondies, all sorts of epithets coming from both angles as you were busy running along the wing. And there were pioneer people who fought against that.
Yes.
And then there was the birth of, you know, the Mean Machine. So I'm just wondering whether, if you were to write a book now, whether you'd find similar milestone moments going from basically rejection to acceptability.
Absolutely. In fact, there are direct parallels. I think I like that you mentioned rugby, because that's one of the places that it was really obvious that this was not ia ikuwa yetu, lakini pia ineza kuwa yetu.
Well, rugby's gone full circle. All the best teams are not from our sort of, you know, custard eating boarding schools.
No,
it's Western Kenya.
It's actually changed completely.
Exactly.
And what happens is that the the ownership in different ways. So the multiplicity of classical music and rugby, to some extent, the dimensions are different. So the culturally speaking, there was a push. So I was lucky to experience the leaders who forged their way, and they said, come, kujeni mucheze. And we said, what we are trying. And these people, they're not letting us. They're looking at us, wana cheka sana, why your clarinet iko na shimo? This thing, your instrument is broken and you can't afford another one. And these guys say to us, play, don't worry, you go there and play this music. And what has happened is, so that whole spectrum happened, and it came from rejection, it came from demarcation, it came from, plus all the cultural nuance of what needs to be destroyed. Some things were destroyed, not because they needed destroying, but because they were representations.
Yeah, just before the break, sentiment. You know, so your conversations are weird, because the weird things come to mind. Something like the Kenya National Anthem, which you could say was written in a sort of classical register.
Yes.
So again, the mythology, George Senogazake, a Ugandan guy who was there, and then there was a Mzungu called Graham Hislop.
Yes.
And there's a Hislop sort of hall at the University of Nairobi. Is it a bit like, was an anthem such as ours, was it written by an African?
Very good question. Mm. I think it, oh my goodness.
I don't know, because I mean, because by, a, it's by a bit heritage, like Malaika, who wrote
yes,
it?
Who wrote it? William, no, there's that. There's the artistic side. There's who came up with the art. But also there is those people, I think, had become Africanized enough. Graham Hislop and those people. And I had a conversation with a professor who was part of that committee, who's still around now. And he's very keen to, you can see that somehow the picture that we are fighting for now, they could see it then. They could see that the way to go forward is not black or white. It is picking these things and making something of them.
Yes. Well, we're going to pursue that now, but this clock is ticking away. It is now 18 hours, 59 minutes and 36 seconds. Time for a break. Luigi, do forgive me. Did I cut you off on ownership of our national anthem?
Well, no, not exactly. But I think that the history of classical music in Kenya is intertwined with the history, with the ownership, because classical music has only existed, first of all. Here's something very interesting. Classical music has never become a marketplace product. It's never fully become a thing that you buy and sell. For this reason, it has only existed because somebody owns it. And so the people who have owned it have worked hard to preserve it, to conserve it, to perform it, had to embed it in their culture, in their way of life, because you have to leave and go and make money in the market as a banker or a lawyer or whatever you need to do, and then still have space for classical music. So if you did not embed it in your way of life, it would die. And so the people that owned it happened to be of a certain demographic, happened to be all Europeans or white Kenyans or really, really extremely wealthy Kenyans for the longest time. And by the time people, so you know, such as, if I dare say myself, were venturing into the waters, not only were we trying to access this overly complicated technical thing, we did not belong to the culture that owns it, to embed it. So for you to participate, you had to try and embed yourself in that way of life in which the music was conserved.
Time is never on our side. I just want, in this particular 15-minute segment, I evoked my own schooling, and let's say that it was privileged and somewhat apart. I'm asking, if we're looking at an overview of 60 years of independence, and we like this thing, I like this thing, I've just hummed something for your delectation, I'm familiar with all these things. Was it part of the syllabus? Was it, you know, the Kenya Schools Music Festival? have there been efforts to expose and expand?
Yes, there has been. In the syllabus, even today, that exam that you described, where you went to the music room and you listened to something and you had to either identify it or write it down, that still happens. If music students at secondary school in Kenya still listen, they still analyze a classical work and they have to say things about it and learn how to do
countrywide. It. Countrywide. Sorry, I'm expressing ignorance here. Countrywide.
Well, yes, countrywide. Unfortunately, not all government schools offer music as an option. So right. Those that offer music, they do the same exam. They sit an exam where they do analysis, what's called analysis, where you study a score of music and you listen to it and you write about the history of the composer. Where was he born? Why did he write it? And they learn how to access classical music. And then they also listen and they do oral skills where you try and notate music. So that is still offered as a curriculum function.
Gwiji, I mean, it's very difficult in a discussion such as this. Kenyans have a problem. I mean, I could make a direct reference to where I come from, to my village. And then terribly for us Kenyans, everything becomes tribal and people are trying to work out whether you come from Karachuonyo or Turkana. But I will say, Gwiji, that in my village, let me think about this carefully before I come out with the punchline. I've never seen a kid holding a violin.
No, absolutely not. And that will be...
But there are government schools. You see the elephant in the room that I'm
trying
to raise from the dead.
There are government schools. I understand that.
Yes. There are schools.
Yes, there are schools. Now, what happens is
there
those
schools... There is no violin.
They have no violin. They have a record player and they listen to the violin. And the teacher says, "Yo, unasikia hapo kando, yo imepita, yo ni violin. Aya ngoja usikie hii bumbu, hasa hiyo ni." So they listen and then sometimes the teachers get it wrong. Sometimes the teachers get it wrong. Sometimes the children, they have a rough... So in to answer the question, is it in the curriculum? Yes. In what form and to what extent and what impact it does, that's a different question, but it is in the curriculum. Classic music, as when you study music generally, you do Western music, you do African music.
Yeah, but people are obliged. This is because there's so many ways to approach this. We've talked about tranquility, the appreciation of solitude, the idea of concentration, the idea of discipline.
Yes.
All these things that could pass perhaps more effectively than being in a rugby team where somebody's going to make you concussed, break your fibula or tibula. I mean, it's a much more genteel way of learning discipline and teamwork.
Yes.
But I still say, because the Kenya we want, with all our hustling and grabbling and, you know, becoming overnight millionaires, it seems to me that we are losing direct efforts to make ourselves appreciative of culture and being cultured and refined.
Yes.
Is that a terrible sort of stab in the foot to whatever one does to one's foot?
I would put it differently. I have to agree with what you're saying, and I have to put it differently and say it's not culture, it's what we make of our culture, rather than a culture being something that we access and learn how to get to. It's putting the meaning into our way of life as it is now. So you have to live the experience, because our psychology, you know, for thousands of years, bado tunasikia maumivu, we feel pain, we feel anger, we feel sadness. So if we can find ways to try and do that, it will lead us necessarily to endeavors like playing that kind of music that calms the nerves or that expresses another level of emotion that is part of what you're trying to say. So, Mwalimu, let me give you a point that I think highlights what I'm trying to say. We leave the market without a doubt. Tukienda kwa matanga, and now tuanze kuimba chaku tumaini sina, and everybody gets to the same emotional state. Not because they are paying money for it.
Yes.
Na tukienda kwa harusi, when a child is born, when a mother is singing a lullaby to a child, and the mother is singing, and you tell the mother, fanya hivi, wewe ujaimba, wewe, you're out of tune, weka mtoto chini umcheze recording ya mtu mwingine mwenye ni professional.
Yes.
The mother will tell you, get out. Because when she's singing, she's expressing the highest level of expression that she can imagine.
Yes.
Now, this is what I'm talking about. Collectivizing that expression leads to this kind of endeavor. Classical music grew because they collectivized some kind of expression. And when somebody came and said, "There's an expression imetoka huko, can you do it?" Then you're like, "Why? Me? I'm living. I'm alive. I've got an expression that I'm living. I ingine ni anini." So the challenge is to then, it's not about even elevating anything, just about creating the space for that expression. And if you listen to any people, whatever the level of hustle and bustle, if you listen to them when the market keeps quiet a bit, na umerudi nyumbani and it is just you and your spirit, whatever that is that you need to say, that's where classical music would survive.
I agree with you entirely. There's no need for us to disagree, because I agree with you. But I'm trying to sort of say heroes, washuja.
Yes.
Again, the image that will come to mind for people who live in Nairobi, and that's a question to come, is that beyond Nairobi, is there life in the classical world?
Mm-hmm.
But we have seen the advent of one Yo-Yo Ma.
Yes.
And, you know, some people say, I haven't got his names right. Maybe he's Ma Yo-Yo.
Ma Yo-Yo.
Okay. But anyway, this...
Ma Yo.
Yeah, exactly. So this guy comes through, you know, sort of Martian fellow lands.
Yes.
What was absolutely extraordinary is that, that without any advertising that I saw, without any sort of, you know, roll of drums,
mm-hmm.
People were ready to go and see this one performance of one man playing the cello for 2.5 hours non-stop from memory. But they were prepared to pay, as I understood it, tens of thousands of shillings.
Yes.
Now, I'm saying 60 years on, are people going to pay thousands of shillings, not tens, to listen to a Kenyan practitioner do the same thing? Because that surely the outcome, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, as we say in England.
Yes, it is only going to happen if we do the collective job as well as the technical job. You see, Yo-Yo Ma came within a couple of weeks of
yes.
the Boys to Men.
Yes, exactly.
Sindio.
Another.
Now, the prices were roughly the same for
exactly.
both concerts. However, kwa Yo-Yo Ma, kulikuwa na kiti kimoja on the stage
yes.
and him and his cello, and then silence. Sindio?
Yes.
Boys to Men, niliona mtandaoni labda kulikuwa with screen, microphone, speaker, kulikuwa na vitu vingine
vingi. No, but we're talking at cross purposes. I'm talking about heroes. Let's just, my question, maybe I posed it wrongly. 60 years on, you know,
yes.
we've got this, I think, you know, whatever the poster said, Kenya at 60.
Yes.
They were, you know, they were borrowing or copying from us. Okay, fine. It's good.
Yes.
Imitation, sincerest form of flattery and all that.
Yeah.
60 years on,
yes.
Guiji.
Yes.
60 years on, who are our Sauti Souls? Who are our Eric Wainainas of the classical music world?
Very good question, Mwalimu. And we are not talking at cross purposes. I think there does not need to be a hero of classical music. No, that's what my point is.
Oh, dear.
Because Yo-Yo Ma existed
because belonging
to a massive community serving an art, not because of any other way. So his output on the cello, right? That is why his best presentation is him playing the cello, right? I think that we will have heroes. We will have now what has happened in Kenya so far. We will have people who will be able to stand out. Even currently, there are exceptionally good instrumentalists and singers of the classical realm in Kenya, you know, rivaling their age mates and their counterparts from anywhere around the world. However, for it to be domiciled completely in the collective culture so that it succeeds, we are still way too young to expect heroes. Yo-Yo Ma is a hero because he stands...
I guess for one reason, he's possibly older than Kenya is itself.
To some extent,
yes. I think he's probably 65. So I take your point entirely.
There's that. And you see, Yo-Yo Ma also, there's something on YouTube of Yo-Yo Ma meeting...
John F. Kennedy.
Now, how old was Yo-Yo Ma?
And
video?
Playing with his sister as
yes.
a seven-year-old.
There you go. So what happens is...
As refugees from France.
By that time, Yo-Yo Ma was already showing this exceptional talent and standing completely in the... So Yo-Yo Ma has been engulfed in this community of support from that time to now, world over. And so that's why the question...
The reason I'm going to stay with it just for a while
yes.
to sort of nitpick... is that the hero is worthy of imitation. So,
yes.
So let the hero, the heroine, somebody one wishes to be like.
Yes.
So I'm saying if we had invited the whole of the Kenyan cabinet to attend the Yo-Yo Ma concert, would they have come? My answer is no, they wouldn't have, because they'd have prepared to have some sort of rally planning a demonstration the next day. So there's a if you don't appreciate it, how are we going to get it?
How are we going to get it there? Because what will happen is, you're right.
Yes.
It would have been difficult to sell to some quarters of our society, of our leaders, for example, in different fields, to come to the Yoma concert. Yet the concert sold out.
Yes.
Yet the concert sold out. And the people that went there. Now, I'll tell you a story about Yoyoma's visit. That's special. For the whole preparation of Yoyoma, Yoyoma was supposed to come in 2020. And that was cancelled because of COVID.
Yes.
And Nairobi. So it was going to be June 2020 when Yoyoma was here. And right from then, the clamor and the preparation and the excitement around Yoyoma spoke about everything to do with Nairobi, except the cello. And so when this year, finally, when Yoyoma came to Kenya, the cellists felt like they were out in the cold. And they were like, this is amazing. This is like Lionel Messi coming to Nairobi and Gor Mahia being told, stay away.
Yes.
This is for some other special people who are transporting him and taking care of him. But by providence, by I don't know how, by the workings of some very, you know, hardworking people, Yoyoma ended up meeting some of the cellists who've been working very hard to learn to play the cello.
Right.
And these people, I was talking to one of those young people who was saying, actually, she got to meet Yoyoma. She spoke to Yoyoma. And to her, that is life-changing, of great proportions. Even more, she couldn't have afforded the tickets to go and watch Yoyoma live. But somehow, in the movement in Nairobi,
right,
I don't know if it was Yoyoma's own grace or his organizers or somebody making this happen, Yoyoma got to speak to these young cellists. And even if it's just for a passing minute, those lives are changed forever. Now, the heroism, I think, is in the people behind the scenes that made that happen.
Right.
Or in that, that is, I think, the real heroism. And for classical music, I have to maintain that we have to not look for heroism in that way. It's going to happen anyway.
Okay.
It will happen automatically.
Very subtle, very nuanced. I'll have to go home and unpack your riposte. But for the moment, we're going to take a break. Thank you very much. Capital FM. Guiji, the last 13 or so minutes, where should we go from here? I guess we go to the future. But before then, again, name, maybe some people do deserve publicity and whatever can be gained from this sort of thing. I'd like to for you to evoke the activities of Elizabeth Njoroge and the Ghetto Classics, and also the Safaricom Youth Orchestra, which we know about, because in their, in some way they're representative of... what they call the idea of patronage, the idea of somebody helping you, you know, going to Louis XVI or whatever, going to the king for you to write plays, Shakespeare. These are the guys. So what are they doing, and are other people, should they be encouraged to do what they're doing? Because two is not enough.
No, I'm happy that you've mentioned that, because I was, these are the people that I was referring to when I say there's people who came in and said, go ahead, play this music, you can do it. In the case of Elizabeth Njoroge, her, she deserves a special mention, because she's doing what classical music needs for it to survive. She's domiciling it in a community. She's making it a way of life for the people that play it. That is very interesting. So instead of saying, we're going to get you out of this village to go and play classical music over there, she said, we're going to make classical music your way of life here. And immediately getting hundreds of young people to access that discipline that you mentioned earlier, Mwalimu. You said your discipline, your focus, your interrogation. So Elizabeth Njoroge is achieving that. And when I first met Elizabeth Njoroge in 2007, she has a simple way of making the impossible seem possible. So she will listen and she'll say, okay, what do you want to do? Why do you want to do that? And then she'll say, okay. And then she'll give you a call some months later and say, okay, look, can you meet me this place this time tomorrow? And somehow this, so in many ways, if I speak for us who are, I like to call myself part of the engine that, you know, under the hood, just carrying on with the music. And and we are not the car, we're not the thing that people see outside the facade. But so what happens is Elizabeth has allowed us to do our work, because what she says is, she opens doors and says, you know, this is what needs to happen, and she somehow makes it possible. And so the Safaricom Youth Orchestra, Ghetto Classics that you've mentioned, an amazing program, and then There's something called the Link Up Schools program. There's the National Youth Orchestra of Kenya. There's a continued support of the Kenya Conservatories of Music and the orchestras that run there. Interesting that now there's 7 or 8 orchestral rehearsals in Nairobi every week of different groups of different ages. And what has happened is that is possible because somebody has actually made it possible to for that to happen. She's opened doors, she's opened spaces, she's created the awareness. And you know, I have to give that to her. But we have had to also work very hard not to let her down because she's not a technician. She doesn't go to the classroom and teach how to play the instrument. So those of us who are teachers of instruments, those of us who, you know, sing or conduct or play instruments, have had to not let her down. I've had to go into those spaces and deliver. And that partnership has led to a massive change in the spectrum of classical music, as happened in rugby some years ago, has now happened in classical music. So you go anywhere, and even the people in Walikuwa na Tuchekelea in 2002, 2003, are now saying they can see, even if they might not say Ejafika standards here, Paris,
yes,
but they will say that is something special. And I have to mention that on the other side, so we know Elizabeth Njoroge. I want to mention there's a dozen very highly placed operators under the hood. And I right. think those are as much heroes.
Yes, I'd like significantly. Yes.
I'll say in my experience, there's a guy called Atigala Luvai, who was the director of the Conservatory of Music in 2000s.
Yes.
And he was a particular significant educational and community impact to this day.
Yes.
And the conservatoire's community, because the conservatoire doesn't have the level of funding that you might get, for example, maybe a Ghetto Classics or Safaricom Youth Orchestra, but the conservatoire's standards are no different because it's based in the community.
Right.
And then there is a composer called Njane Mugambi.
Yes, indeed.
So Njane Mugambi has been writing music, consistently. He's been writing music consistently. I don't know if I can be heard. I can't hear myself.
Okay, well, just speak on.
Yes.
Assume that Njane you are.
Njane Mugambi has been writing music, whether there was an audience or not, writing good quality music and putting it out. But behind as writing of the music, Njane has also spent a lot of time teaching music and teaching people how to think about music and unclassicalizing music. So he said, this is not, so I'm going to use the tools and I'm going to write our music. I'm going to write Maasai music, Luo music, using the tools that we've learned from classical music.
And it's significant because I started off with reference to the Kenya at 60 concert.
Yes.
And there we had Njane Mugambi's composition about the building of the Kenya-Uganda Railway.
Yes.
And also mention of some genius child from Kenya in either Texas or somewhere busy. And there were lots of compositions that were by Kenyans.
By Kenyan composers, yes. I must say that Njane Mugambi, yes, he's written a lot, especially about the environment.
Yes.
And he's written specifically about the history of Kenya, culturally apt and very, very high level thinking in terms of technique and harmony, how the music is put together,
right?
But also highlighting the community side of that. Njane has worked a lot. A lot of us have leaned on him for you know.
Time is not support. On our side. I'm going to give you 2 minutes before we find out who you are, why are you here, what are you doing. But the Nairobi focus, everything is Nairobi centric. Be it the theatre. I can see that there's wings of flutter in Kisumu theatrically, but countrywide, Mombasa, Kisumu, Nakuru, Eldoret, is there a vibrancy equally?
Yes, it is growing now. Back to the answer that classical music will have to be a way of life for it to exist. It will not survive as a marketplace product. We have Nakestra, the Nakuru Orchestra, effort by some of the young people in the recent past. They've played in Nakuru from time to time. And there's also a fairly busy scene in Mombasa. And actually, there's the program you mentioned, Ghetto Classics. Ghetto Classics has a very vibrant center in Mombasa currently.
Yes.
And where young children are getting access to this music. We are not there yet. Eldoret, Moi Girls Eldoret, there's been quite a vibrant music department that has then led to some effort around Eldoret for classical music. And so I think that we will get there. Moi High School, Kabarak, that's another place making quite a big difference. Kabarak University out of town, Baraton University. So there is there is pockets of change.
Right.
And I think we just have to keep going. The ship is facing the right direction. We just have to keep sailing.
Who are you, sir?
My name is Levi Wataka. I'm a music teacher and I'm the resident conductor of the Nairobi Orchestra.
Right. Okay. Bwana Wataka, thank you for revealing yourself. And now I'm beginning to doubt whether I can be heard, but we soldier on because we're on our own.
Yes.
Let's keep the conversation going and see what happens. Now, tell us about yourself in the 3 or 4 minutes which remain.
Yes.
How did you get to this exalted position of wielding a baton?
Very good. I started out, I was very lucky, Mwalimu, and I can now disclose, now that we have reached that level, that the school that I went to was how I first came to understand this side of music. So I went to Lenana School.
Yes.
And while there I was exposed, I discovered...
So you're a fellow Libon.
I'm a fellow Libon,
with a 20 generational gap.
With a small generational gap.
Yes, 25 years is a long time. But go on.
And then I
won't hold it against you for being young. What happened?
And from Lenana, I went on to take...
So was there somebody sort of not beating you across the block and forcing you to listen to the New World Symphony, as Mr. Robin Walton did to me?
Actually, no. They were doing... They were asking us to do other things, you know, but they made us sing late into the night and get the notes perfectly right so that you can get on the bus to be in the choir and go to Precious Blood. And
you had to
earn your place in the choir.
Yes.
But I got to lead the choir at Lenana and then went on to study music at Kenyatta University and ended up learning to play the piano and starting to play as what's called a rehearsal accompanist for the Nairobi Music Society. Hapo ndo nikakutana na hasa wale ambao walikuwa wamefanya hii kazi for many, many years.
Right.
And
so
it was out of there that somebody spotted a possibility. One of the conductors that was visiting from England said, "Hey, listen, why don't you wave your arms a bit? You seem to have an understanding." And the rest is history. So from that time in 2004, when I first stood up and attempted to conduct a group of any kind.
Yes.
And then many years of study, lots of traveling later, we're here and trying to get better, but also always making sure to keep the door open.
A question, we've got maybe 2 or 3 minutes. Access to instruments. You played the piano. Again, did somebody say to you, "My son, here's a piano, play it"?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I used to come from... So my parents moved to Ongata Rongai when I was, after high school. So I discovered the Conservatory of Music and I used to hang out at the National Theatre and I would... now I can hear myself better. I would offer. So this guy that I mentioned earlier, Tigala Luvai, noticed, said, you're working very, very hard. You love this thing, don't you? So he gave me odd jobs to do in return for a few minutes in the piano room. That's before I went to university. So I learned to play piano literally by being very resilient and taking any opportunity. When I got to university and I was asked to choose an instrument, since I was a music student, I chose the piano. And I was one of those people who were at Kenyatta University during our years will remember, we lived in the music room. We stayed there almost overnight and were dozing through lectures because we had to practice to catch up.
May I give you a minute to give a word of inspiration and encouragement to any young parent who'd like to follow in your footsteps?
Yes. First thing is, it is part of the journey. Make it a way of life because it has a lot of benefits, not down the road like we do in many other endeavors. It has benefits now. If you commit to it, the regularity and consistency starts to pay back immediately. And as long as it is embedded in your way of life, you will be able to succeed in classical music. It will not work well if you... the other way around. It's not that fanya hivi kwamba badaye utakuja kupata kazi nzuri or whatever. I think classical music works well if you make it something that benefits you today and benefits those around you as you go, as a way of life, as a culture.
Is there money in it?
There can be. There is a lot of money in classical music. I'm not a financial expert, neither am I a business expert. I don't know how the money moves. But for example, for an orchestra, you came to the at 60 Nairobi, Kenya at 60 concert, the fans, like, so the instruments on the stage, just the instruments, if you were to cost the instruments on the stage, you're talking millions.
Yes.
So there is money in classical music. How it moves, do you mean this? Is there a profit? Is that what you're asking?
No, can you make money?
Can you make money? Yeah. That's a challenge world over.
Yeah, because you're a music teacher, so yes. I guess that's your base.
That's my base.
But conducting the Nairobi Orchestra is not paying you millions. You've got very little time to answer that question.
That's hardly paying me at all. Many conductors around the world are not paid. I don't think it has money in that sense. It can have money. We need to think better around how to monetize what the orchestra offering is. A work in progress, Mwalimu.
It's just past 19 hours, 30 minutes and 51 seconds East African time. Time to stop. Do continue to give us feedback, hopefully positive and reassuring, on the Twitter handle at Capital FM Kenya, or drop us a text or WhatsApp message on 0701-984-984. I've been talking to Levi Wataka, music teacher and conductor of the Nairobi Orchestra. And you've been listening to John Sibiokumu on Wednesday. Thank you most kindly. Very much obliged. Next time will be after a short break. But there will be a next time, so till then.